when you're measuring very high currents and very high powers for broadcast stations, because they put out megawatts of power, and you're not going to have a megawatt meter in your shack, that's for sure. It's going to be at the antenna, and it's going to be operated by remote control, and everything is microprocessor controlled, and you know, so on and so forth. So that's the way it is in this day and age. Okay, so again, summarizing, this is the direct method of measuring antenna power, going to your antenna. Now you have what is also known as the indirect method. The indirect method of measuring the carrier power output is used when the licensed antenna has been damaged or destroyed. Also, the power must be measured indirectly when changes are made in the antenna system or the current measurement instrument, or when other changes are made that may alter the characteristics of the antenna. Now this becomes a little bit more involved, because to determine the operating power by the indirect method, you must know, they're talking about tubes here, you must know the plate voltage and current values of the final transmitter amplifier stage and the efficiency factor of the transmitter. And most people wouldn't know what the current is, unless you have one of those sophisticated radios that has a meter on it that actually measures the current being drawn to your final amplifier, which does mine have that? Even on this radio, my ICOM, it doesn't have that. No, it doesn't tell me what the current is. But of course, you could hook up instruments to do it. Again, this is relating to broadcast equipment, so I'm just mentioning it because it's in this particular section of how to measure your power coming out, how to measure antenna power. This is the indirect method. All amplifiers, final amplifiers of transmitters, have a certain efficiency factor, and that's determined by there's a certain number of classes of amplifiers: class A, class B, class C, D. Now they're up to E, F, and G, and so on. Which the boys on AM are experimenting with a lot of that high efficiency transmitters, which are pulsed with modulated and the digital and all this other stuff that's going on now. This book was written back in the 70s or 60s, so it's quite old. Not up with the latest, but it gives you an overview anyway. So, if we go back to when we took our tests to get our license, maybe some of the old timers would see a question on, you know, different types of amplifiers and the efficiencies of the amps, and how we even determine that efficiency for either the solid state or tube type amplifiers. So the efficiency factor, and I'm reading this here, the efficiency factor takes into consideration the tank circuit and transmission line losses and depends on the rated power and the modulation method used. This information can be obtained from the transmitter manufacturer or from the FCC. So, anyway, just saying that. If anybody's interested, it goes into a little bit of talk here, and it says when the plate voltage, when they talk about plate voltage, you're talking about tubes, because tubes have a plate, they have a grid, they have a cathode, and all that stuff. If you're still running anything that's got tubes in it. So when the plate voltage and plate current and efficiency factor are known, the operating power can be computed by using a formula. You know, it's a power formula. It's E times I times K. And now you use, you know, because P equals E times I, but now you're going to add in the K factor, which is the efficiency factor of the amplifier. And again, I'm just reading this and they go into this example. So it says, for example, suppose a final stage of a 1,000-watt transmitter is plate modulated and has a plate voltage of 3,000 volts, a plate current of 0.51 amps, that's like a half an amp, and an efficiency factor of 0.65, the operating power in this case will be 3,000 times 0.5 times 0.6, which is 995 watts. This is an acceptable value for a transmitter whose authorized operating power is 1,000 watts. So it's meeting the FCC spec because it's below the maximum power that they allow, which is 1,000. This is putting out 995 watts. So it's an acceptable number. All right. Anyway, this is just about, again, the indirect method of measuring power. So just keep that in mind. It goes on, the FCC requires that each station be operated at all times as near to the authorized power as possible. Variations from 5% above to 10% below the authorized power are the maximum permitted, and these may not occur except for short periods. You can see from the preceding discussion that the direct method is the easiest it makes and is the most accurate. The indirect method is used only in an emergency. So that's it. That's the difference. So you guys out there that you want to measure your plate voltage and your plate current, you could do that. If you have a tube radio. And you can do that to your amplifiers also. But be careful because you got thousands of volts. And you got to keep safety in mind. I do not recommend doing that unless you really know what you're doing, especially with high voltage. Okay, this is a WA2CDL, Andy's Corner. And I guess, let's see. What's the next segment here? This is, gets into a little bit of a discussion. You know what, I'm going to save this, because it's going to be a little bit interesting to try to figure out right now. So I think for now, even though it's only 10 after 9, I might have said enough for people to absorb a little bit. I'm trying to stay away from any of these crazy diagrams. So Roy, I'll give it back to you for now. And, this will be another episode, a slight episode of Andy's Corner. And we'll continue, and then we'll eventually go on to some broadcast antenna subjects, which will be the next section. Okay, thank you, Roy. Back to you. This is Andy's Corner, WA2CDL. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. I appreciate it, and all the kind words you said. So that's another episode of Andy's Corner, and I look forward to next week's episode as well. I am once again AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Limewire Technical Net. And if you have any questions of a technical nature, any topics you'd like to discuss, this is as good a time as any. Just hit that push talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, is that all right with you, Andy?
What was the question? There was so much noise, I couldn't hear that.
Andy, this is Wayne. I'm going back to Marconi antennas. I've been hearing a lot about NSET long wire, NSET variable length wire antennas using an unknown and a tuner. It sounded to me that that's just another name for a Marconi antenna.
Yeah, a vertical antenna is known as a Marconi. Yes, that's what they call it. Right. And it's right. You don't need a balance. It's not a balanced antenna like a dipole is. That's right.
I've been hearing a lot about them. That's a good alternative for portable operation. So I was going to wind my own unarmed. I'm just waiting to get it for it. For.
Yeah, okay. There's many interesting articles on how to wind, the way to wind it, the core to use, and so on. And, you know, using the core is also important because core material can be affected by the amount of power that you're putting into it. There's a thing called saturation, and that produces other effects. You know, it's another whole discussion, but they probably go into that also. All right. Thanks, Wayne. Back to Lloyd.
Okay, thank you very much, Wayne. Thank you very much, Andy. I wouldn't be a proper TechNet if I didn't put in my 2 cents. I would not try to consider an NSET to be similar to a Marconi antenna. Marconi antennas are, as Andy mentioned, they're basically, if you take a standard dipole, a two-element balanced half-wave dipole with a center feed, and you placed a infinite sheet of metal as a mirror and then took away one of the legs, that's more of a Marconi antenna. What's happening is that the mirror virtual image of the monopole on the other side is sort of what's doing the magic, at the expense of cutting the impedance down from about 73 to half of that. And then, you know, you rotate it 90 degrees and it's a vertical quarter wave. Really, you should consider a half-wave NSET to be a modified standard dipole. A dipole is a half-a-wavelength long. The lowest impedance for that dipole is in the center, where it's approximately 73 ohms in free space, closer to 50 ohms when you get close to the Earth. If you then move the center feed off-center, the impedance will go up. If you move it all the way to the end, it will get to the point where it goes from about 50 ohm nominal near Earth to 2 or 3,000 ohms. That's why you need a 7-to-1 transforming balun that will, or anon, that will be a 49-to-1 impedance match. And then it brings you closer to the range where an antenna tuner can do the job. So you should sort of consider it as an NSET, a dipole, as opposed to a quarter wave vertical.
All right, boy. So the Marconi would be a shorter antenna because it's only a quarter wave.
Yeah, it's a shorter antenna. Also, it's an unbalanced and requires some form of a counterpoise. If your NSET half wave is well designed and resonant, theoretically you don't need any kind of a counterpoise to it. What happens is people don't use it as a single frequency radiator or receiver. They use it as a broadband, where it operates multimodal at the cost of the impedance sliding every which way. under those circumstances for something like that, you then require a counterpoise. Otherwise, a lot of the RF at certain frequencies will go right down your transmission line into your shack. But one of the things is it's half the size of a half-wave radiating antenna. So, yes, it's shorter. Although, as we've mentioned in the past, you can build mechanically shortened objects and electronically lengthen them by the use of a loading coil or a capacitive hat. Yes, David.
You know, I'm listening to all these discussions about antennas. You know, what about a dipole with a ground plane element? I've seen these antennas. You can set them up as a V shape, horizontal shape, vertical shape, or an L shape, where the counterpoise is horizontal and the poise is vertical.
Not exactly what I would call a dipole. It's a monopole counterpoise, and the counterpoise can be directed in any direction, fit and or price to be paid. If you and I think we talked about this last week with someone. If you take a quarter wave a ground plane type of antenna and mount it at the back of your car and use the chassis of your car body as a ground plane, it's going to direct a significant amount of the signal forward as opposed to being omnidirectional if you planted it on the hood of a car. So you can certainly orient it every which way. You're going to distort the omnidirectional nature of a vertical with something like at least three ground planes, but you can do it. It's no problem. You're not breaking any law of physics.
Well, I was doing some experimenting with two mobile antennas. I was set to 40 meters, set to 20 meters. I tried it. Over, vertical, horizontal, and ground plane. And so far, I can't really say I have scientific results, except I was able to make contact from the second floor apartment in the middle of Manhattan. So I was pretty happy.
Well, there are an almost infinite number of variations in antenna design. Most of them for amateur radio operators are of a standing wave nature. As was mentioned last week by Andy, there are another class of antennas called traveling wave antennas, which have their benefits and their costs. But, you know, ultimately, whatever works for you. You know, some old-timers who have a lot of spare room, you know, a regular antenna farm, we'll put up these massive double exactly what they called again the floating dirigibles bazookas. They're basically they're coaxial radiators. And they have a very low Q and a very high bandwidth, and they're cut to resonant frequencies, and they'll have them all over the place, elevated a proper height, and have Zeppelin, extended Zeppelin, double Zeppelin, extended Zeppelin. Thank you very much, Ken. And they're in their glory. They don't believe in antenna tuners. They just believe in a lot of antenna switches, and they have a lot of lamps. The rest of us in the real world, we have little bits and pieces of wire for the most part, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't work. So whatever works for you, David, as I've always said, that's the best solution.
Well, I have to be very thankful, you know, that all of this information is available because, you know, I think the more you work towards theory of the antenna, you know, you probably get a better result, you know. And if you're experimenting, it's good to incorporate the theory into it, so maybe you can achieve a better result.
Well, yeah, again, experimentation is part of this hobby. And some people kind of take that on all the time. They're always experimenting. They're never happy with the antenna that they have. It's always the next antenna that they're designing. And they will have these antenna simulation software and run all kinds of patterns. And for them, that's part of the joy. Others want to get something that kind of sort of works. And they want to stick with it for the long term. So again, whatever works for the individual, as long as you get out to the degree that you're comfortable and enjoying the hobby, that's all that really counts. I mean, unfortunately, there are cases where you can see them in EHAM reviews where people have kind of gotten used with mediocre results and switched to a better design for them. Got out a lot farther, and it was kind of like a eureka moment for them. But, you know, whatever you're comfortable with and that you're able to accomplish. Some people, unfortunately, are stuck with HOAs where they can barely put anything up. And so, you know, we all have to live with our compromises in this life.
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm very thankful that my antenna 100 degrees angle, so it's kind of bent, and you know, I get a pretty decent result with it, so I can't complain at all. And by the way, I really do like the digital mode, and I like to try network radio more.
Okay, I mean, you certainly have the opportunity to. There are so many aspects of the hobby. If you find something that interests you, you want to experiment, you want to explore, you want to seek out people or technology, it's available. And for the most part, it's not terribly expensive. You know, if you really look back in the history books of people who didn't quite wire up their own radios, but bought them from other people. If you look at the actual price that they paid and inflation, it cost them a pretty penny through the years. And you know, they would be amazed at things like a Baofeng. You know, I mean, I can't even begin to guess in 1920 money what a Baofeng would be worth. 10 cents, 15 cents. You know, I'd have to do the math.
Well, I have to say, the first radio transmitter that I had, I built it from scratch from a television set parts, mostly parts, a couple of different components from Radio Shack, and, you know, it worked. I was able to get the signal out, probably about 5 watts out, new crystal.
Well, yeah, I mean, the best thing for a young ham to putter around with and try and build himself is something like a QRP transceiver or transmitter. I think there's a strange circuit board that's sold that comes out of China. I wouldn't really suggest it because it's probably not well engineered and you'll burn it out by just looking at it askance. But I think they sell it for about $5 and it puts out a ridiculous thing like a couple of watts of CW power with a crystal. They're still around. There are better designs other than that Chinese board, but they cost a bit more. So it's still a possibility. So the problem is that the people that are building things are now kind of makers. They're more interested in servos and telemetry and other things rather than learning Morse code. So It's sort of, unfortunately, an end of an era. Occasionally, there are youngsters who join us in this hobby, but they probably tend to be from families of hams. I don't know if there's that many newbies where no one in the family had anything to do with amateur radio. Again, it's a great hobby, but unfortunately, for some reason, over the last 50-odd years, radio frequency electronics has seemingly become mundane to too many people. It's taken for granted. People don't even think of cell phones as RF devices if you really talk to them about it. They're just these wireless thingamabobs.
Yeah, I hear you. Back in 1974, CW rocked. It's all I did was CW. I didn't think that so many years later I would be playing around on that.
Well, I mean, that's the beauty of the future. I can't recall how many popular science articles I read predicting the future, and almost all of them had to do with flying cars for some strange reason. So, you know, our imagination is not capable of predicting what the future holds for us. And that's probably a good thing. It would be sort of boring if we had it all figured out at the beginning. But yeah, although, you know, people were very annoyed, upset, what have you, when the FCC decided to eliminate the CW requirement. They predicted that the stupefaction of amateur radio, and I don't think that's the case. I think that the guys are rather clever and smart, and a lot of them, even though they didn't need to learn the code, are studying it. There's the Long Island CW Club, which is very active, and I am told that Morse code keys are selling better now than they have in decades. So Morse code is still alive. We have some people who love it dearly. I can recall before I got my license, Mel, K2KEY, was a big CW fan. He would apparently go to sleep with CW in the background. So CW is alive and living and well, even despite the fact that the FCC no longer requires us to learn it.
Good. Yeah, but he was like what Rich was talking about, you know, to have a quality QSO. I didn't think that I could continue having quality QSO with CW, so I went to SSD. But I think the present moment really is everything. Everything that happens, everything that is happening right here and now, and, you know, not tomorrow and not yesterday.
Okay, living in the moment, I think actors tend to use that phrase. It depends on the individual. I really enjoy a rad show. I enjoy exchanging ideas and information and thought processes. I'm very curious about people. I'm not that curious about what they had for lunch. Maybe that's something that I have to correct. But you know, technology, science, history, language, all kinds of fun stuff. You'll find in people on the HF and thankfully on repeaters as well.
QSF. Let's see if anybody else wants to talk to you. I know that time is of the essence, and if not, then I have a question for you. So let's see if anybody else has a question. K2R1.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Mess. So if you have a question of a technical nature or a topic you'd like to discuss, please give me your first name and your call sign.
A2GJE.
Yes, Ed, what can I do you for tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Roy. Just a suggestion for some topics that our expert there on antennas might want to go into. He spoke about efficiency. If sometime one evening he might talk about Class A, B, C, and this new mode that some people are operating with all solid-state equipment called Class E, which I think is a pulse width kind of modulation. I find that to be very interesting. Over.
I agree with you, Ed. Matter of fact, Andy is friendly with a group of AM aficionados who build their own equipment in the Northeast, and a lot of them have built devices that utilize these pulse-modulated methods of amplification, E, F, G, all those fun letters of the alphabet. So I hope that Andy also, at one point or another, covers amplifier design and the differences. Most of us have experienced A and B and AB and even C amplifiers, but I think the technological advance with the pulse-modulated technologies of the higher letters in the alphabet are rather fascinating. So I agree with you completely, Ed.
Most of us are not tackling anymore. The folded dipole, the three-wire dipole, and years ago I used to know somebody. He said that wire antennas have to be fed with wire, and he had a beautiful dipole in the backyard, but it was fed with homemade open wire line. Very, very interesting. But he was an old timer, and he's a silent key now. But he said wire antennas have to be fed with wire. Over.
Well, a wire transmission line, open line, have great benefits. Yeah, the nature of physics is you never get away with anything. You pay your money, you get your item. Twin pairs have very low loss. Their attenuation losses are much better than any coax you can come up with. But the problem is that you have to be very closely taking a look at the path that the transmission line is following. If there's bits and pieces of metal getting near them, they can couple to them and cause problems. The beauty of coaxial cable that was pretty much an invention, it was an invention of the late 19th, early 20th century, but it didn't actually get produced in enough quantities and price to be reasonable for amateurs to use until after World War II was over, and there was a great surplus of coaxial cable. And the great benefit of coaxial cable is hit on anything. You could layer it in the middle of a steel drum. It wouldn't tear. Whereas with open line, you couldn't. But I agree with you that open line is a fascinating transmission line. It was the transmission line for amateurs before World War II to kind of to make a rule that wire requires wire. I don't know. What does that really get you? I mean, it probably would be a nice thing if you were able to run a Yagi using open line as well. So I wouldn't say it's only good for wire either. But you know, like all things, it's just cleaner, easier to throw a coax cable onto the ground rather than open line. But I could certainly understand the value for open line transmission lines.
A2GJE. No doubt property, and you have to run the wire away from other objects. It's good if you have some nice property out of this area, we usually property shy, and we try and do the best that we can. And another thing, Andy was mentioning about measuring antenna current. That has to be done with a thermocouple ammeter. And if you do want to use one and you want to build a little case with it, to put some wire mesh across the ammeter so that the ammeter itself does not radiate. Just some things of the past. No one does that anymore either. And the other thing is, one time we were allowed 1,000 watts plate input power, plate voltage multiplied by plate current. And after that, the FCC changed it to, I believe, 1,500 watts peak envelope power. If Andy can speak sometime about measuring peak envelope power, that's very critical for those running sideband, over.
Okay, those are very good suggestions, Ed. Hopefully Andy heard them. If not, I will relay them sometime this week when I chat with him. But I appreciate all these thoughts. There is so much to talk about with this hobby. To a degree, some people kind of get a little tired of discussing antennas all the time, but antennas are probably the most important variable that new amateurs have to deal with. Gone are the days where you put together your own transmitter, receiver, and collection of crystals and such. You just basically open your credit card, your wallet, give a HRO credit card number, and there it is sitting on your desk. But antennas are kind of a black art. You know, some of us know some of the theory, but sometimes these things work even beyond how the theory tells you they do. So we keep going back to antennas, but again, there's a lot of other aspects of the hobby that certainly should be explored.
K2GJE, most of us buy transceivers now, including myself. I still have some boat anchors around that I keep running, just for the interest of keeping them running. But antennas, well, you could go out and buy a lot of antennas. It's amazing what you can though get away with it in a small area if you have to. When I was in the service, we had some very, very good transmitters of considerable power. What we did have was a very, very good antenna tuner that had some beautiful air variable vacuum capacitors that even if you had an SWR, they didn't arc over. And the only thing we were transmitting with on the antenna side was about an 8-foot whip, period. That was it. And we did have an SWR meter. It was very interesting. I used to service those, over.
Yeah, I have a, I actually have two PALSTARs. I have a manual PALSTAR, I have an HF auto PALSTAR, and I often will remark that I could probably tune up a doorknob if I had to. But you'll get arguments. I'm sure you have on HF. There's a group of guys down there, swear up and down that antenna tuners are just a trick both for your transmitter's output and for your head that gives you a false sense that you're feeding the proper impedance into the antenna system. As far as I'm aware, you're feeding that correct impedance to the antenna system. There is a loss. Matter of fact, the most recent issue of the ARRL's QST has a little design that people can build to calculate what the loss is given on your antenna tuner. It's dependent upon the type of tuning circuit it uses, how efficient it is, how broad range it is, and also the attenuation loss of the transmission line. But it does impose some degree of a loss, but I would never give my antenna tuner away.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
He mentioned a vacuum capacitor that I've never seen, never heard of it. So maybe you can describe that. Do they exist today? It sounds like a great idea that, you know, it's possible for something almost to arc over in a vacuum. Are they large, small? What's the history on that? Back to you, Roy.
WS2N K2GJE, I did not hear Roy come back, over.
Stand by, we got to reestablish the link.
WS2N K2GJE. I don't know if it's a system problem. Over.
Please stand by. I'm trying to reestablish the link. NY2H.
No.
Connected to reflector 9126.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Gelato.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
is AC2 I'm trying directly to Glen Oaks. It's probably going to be north. So I might give you a little bit of a transmission report.
AC2GS, WS2N. A little noisy, you're making it, but I don't know how it's going to go. Try again.
Okay, that's it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58,
do bring up the link, and he asked us to stand by, so I don't know if I'm fouling him up by talking right now, but to let you know, that's where we're at. I'm on the chat room if you want to go back and forth until we get back. Mostly noise. All right, standing by. WS1, you're right. WS2N, NY2H. NY2H, WS2N. Go ahead. Yeah, I can't even get into play of you on the computer, so I think we're dead in the water. Do you want to do the space report? Okay, I'll let Roy know I'm on the chat right now with him. We'll do that for now, and that'll be it. He tried making it before, but he's too noisy. I mean, a couple more watts, he would be there, but he's already at his limit. All right. I'll stand by NY2H.
Has he come into Echo? It looks like he's logged on there. I'm going to be getting to the next stuff.
Okay. Yeah, Lou, before he told me to go ahead, we'll do that for now. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, try to make it back later. The conditions will be a little bit better where he can get in direct. But for now, we'll just do the SpaceNet report. We have a few issues here, a few topics. The first one I had was had to do with the space launch system, the SLS, that's being built by Boeing and Lockheed, and the rocket that will eventually go to the moon.
So it means they'll find that. But it's been under development, I think, for about 12 years now. Way over course. We were, I think it's like $12 billion or more, or maybe even up to higher than that. Anyway, the four rocket engines are going to be tested with the core fuel tank that's going to be sitting on top of these four rocket engines on the 18th of March. You know, it's not going anywhere, but I like to watch this thing. It's bolted into a test stand in Stennis, Mississippi. They tested it about a month or so ago. They were supposed to have the rocket fire for 8 minutes, which would be as long as they need to get the rocket, if it did launch, to space before the next stage took over. But, you know, it shut down after a little over a minute and due to one of these valves that didn't work properly. And anyway, they worked on it and they put it back together, took it apart, everything's fine. And they're going to test it again on the 18th, which should be interesting. It creates a lot of steam. What's bulky to use there? It's actually steam. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. You know, this test stand is like 30 stories high down in Mississippi. You know, as they're running it, they're going to skim move it. You're going to see the close-up of the engines moving. Different directions. The computer has it programmed to see if all the movements of all four engines are going to be okay. And each one is pushing out almost 500,000 pounds of thrust. So you have almost 2 million pounds of thrust total when these things go off. So if that's fine, they'll eventually ship that whole core and engine down to Florida, start assembling in the VAB building, the vehicle assembly building, same one that they use for the shuttle and for Apollo. And hopefully by the end of this year, I just don't think they're going to make it. I think it's going to be early next year, but they plan on test flying this first SLS to the moon and back without a crew. So they will launch an unmanned O'Brien spacecraft, which would normally carry four people, pressurized and everything. I mean, you could put four people in it and they would make it. So it'll be your first flight for this, so this is what they do. They will orbit the moon multiple times and eventually come back. And the O'Brien spacecraft will come through the atmosphere, heat shield, four parachutes, and then land in the Pacific Ocean to pick it up. If that goes well, then the next flight will be manned. You'll have the exact same flight, same setup, except you'll have a crew of four orbiting the moon, not going down to the land on the moon, but orbiting the moon, and again returning to Earth. Then Artemis 3, by the way, they call it Artemis, the Artemis program. The Artemis 3 would do the same deal, except the only difference is they would have a lander, and the lander would go down to the surface of the moon, and they would spend a period of time there. The goal is to go down near the south pole of the moon, where there could possibly be frozen ice. Eventually they could find the water down there, but if they make it there and back, that will be great. And then the following missions after that, they plan on having the Gateway space station orbiting the moon, very high orbit. I think around 24,000 miles high above the moon. And it'll be orbiting on a regular basis. Eventually, you'll have a crew on board that space station. And future landing missions will dock with the Gateway space station. And then they would board a lander plan to take you down to the surface of the moon. That's the present plan. So there's an intermediate step there too before the lander lands on the moon. You have a transition module as well that will take you from this high orbit, 24,000 mile high orbit, down to a low orbit around 68 miles above the surface, and then from there the lander would take them down to the surface, and the reverse would happen when they leave. And hopefully they'll be able to establish a base there, and so they can spend a lot of time in the equipment. So they won't be able to stay at night, so it'll probably be in the beginning of maybe someone in 14 days on the surface. So they get, you know, real good at it. Maybe they'll have nuclear fission generators sitting on the surface. That's the plan in the future. One putting out 10 kilowatts. And once they have that, maybe they'll be able to survive on the moon, even during the night, lunar night. So it all starts with the test firing on March 18th. I plan on watching that. Let me drop it before I move on. This is WS. Maybe it's Paul if anybody has any questions for the space portion of the TechNet. Yeah, just let the ID go by. Everything around here. Okay, I usually have launches and landings early in the morning. Coming up of any importance is going to be a launch from Kazakhstan. The Russians are going to launch a Soyuz rocket. Two Russians on board, and now another American astronaut, Mark Vanderheil. He's been up before. Just recently been told that he's going. He was originally in the backup for Kate Rubin, who's up there now. She's been for many, many months. She's coming back in late April. Mark Vanderheil. And by the way, KG-5 and GSA will be traveling to the International Space Station. And that will be on the 9th of April. And then you'll have a large crew up there temporarily for a week. Right now you have 7 people on board. 4 people that have come up from the United States on the American Dragon vehicle, and then another 3 on another Soviet spacecraft. Presently there. And you'll have another craft that's looking coming up with two Russians and Mark Vanderheil. Temporarily, you'll have 10 people on the International Space Station for about a week. And Kate and his counterparts will come down on another Soyuz spacecraft and land on one big parachute into the steps of Kazakhstan. So, we'll be back to a separate crew.
AC1SAM,
I hear them a little noisy, but I hear you. Go ahead, sir.
This is going to say about you.
Oh.
I was going to ask you if you can go into 7. Your voice is very soft, and the crackle is very loud. So if you want to sell them, come through there.
Okay, it's noisy as well. I think the wind is acting up.